With the second impeachment trial of former President Trump, we're analyzing the historical arc of Trumpism and where it built up within the Republican Party. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We will attempt to connect dots here, looking at a series of leaders and movements, starting at the beginning with what the framers of the Constitution had in mind for America in our simmering, fragile, and unresolved state. Questions to ponder this hour. Did Trump transform the Republican Party? Is Trumpism a broader sea change in conservative politics? It's 800-642-1234. Rick Perlstein is a historian and journalist, a Milwaukee native, by the by. He wrote a series of books about the evolution of American conservatism since the 50s. And his most recent one, released last year, is called Reaganland. Rick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. I always feel like I'm giving back when I go on in like Wisconsin Public Radio.
I was going to say, we'll let you off the hook that you are not in Wisconsin any longer. We'll let it go this once, but we will still try to get you back. So you've connected the insurrection January 6th at the Capitol to our long American traditions that go back to our founding. Can you explain that thread?
That's right. When we formed a constitution in the 1780s, because this fragile project of uniting these 13 colonies into a country hadn't worked, you know, after 1776, you know, folks will remember from their school days the Articles of Confederation, there was a very contentious constitutional convention. And what the southern states said, and these were states already that were running their economies on the basis of slavery, whereas the northern states were moving towards an industrial system and were starting to get rid of slavery, what they said was, if we don't have constitutional checks on the power of the North to tell us what to do about slavery, we won't join the nation, right? Mm. And we're all familiar with those. Those checks were the Senate, right, which gave every state 2 members, no matter how many people were in them. And also senators were then elected by state legislatures, so it wasn't a Democratic branch. We had Electoral College, which, you know, gave states power to elect a president based on, again, those 2 senators plus their representatives. And then for choosing how many representatives they had in the House, we had the 3/5 clause, where every enslaved person was counted as 3/5 of a person for purposes of deciding how many members of Congress each state would have. So the House would have a built-in, the South would have a built-in advantage. And that idea that basically the South had this right to dominate the government of the country, whether they had the number of people to dominate, you know, a democracy, was built into the fabric of the country. And it was built into the kind of political attitudes of the South. And all through the 19th century, one of the most important things ever to happen in American history was that the South's agriculture, they exhausted their soil. And the elites in the South realized that they were going to lose their power in this arrangement unless they created new slave states. And they became kind of almost colonialist. They started the project of moving slavery west and trying to create new states. And that was the dominant conflict in American history. Mm. And it eventually ended in a civil war. And that's the pattern that I kind of, I've kind of theorized that, the South has kind of had this, and I call it broadly the reactionary minority in the country, the kind of the part of the country that doesn't want kind of liberal reform, that wants this kind of semi-feudal kind of system, will use any means at its disposal politically to keep that kind of power. But when it doesn't work, when politics doesn't work, they've always found themselves willing to resort to violence, whether it was the Civil War in the 1860s or the kind of civil violence against the federal government that we saw during the civil rights era of the 1960s.
Well, leap forward, if you will, centuries. Were you surprised the Trump presidency ended in violence, ended in loss of life?
I was not surprised at all. In fact, Vanity Fair magazine invited me and several other writers in after the election in November, I think it was, to write little pieces on how we thought the Trump presidency would end. And I was kind of surprised that most writers didn't talk about the prospect of violence, but that was absolutely my prediction. I think that when it comes to Donald Trump, the fact that he never said anything critical about the part of his constituency that was explicitly violent, you know, whether it was the folks in Charlotte that he said were fine people, or bikers for Trump, or he would talk about all the tough, you know, cops he had on his side. And, you know, he would just constantly just obsess over the fact that he had violent people in his constituency. And for me, that was a way of him saying that if he couldn't keep power through political means, he was perfectly willing to do so through violent means. And it's absolutely the case that ever since, now we know from the timeline, ever since, you know, 2019, he was talking about the fact that, in his opinion, he could only lose if there was election fraud by the Democrats. So he's been setting up this scenario for a very long time.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Rick Perlstein, who's a historian, has chronicled the modern Republican Party. You can join in. What do you think about the second impeachment trial of former President Trump? Is it justified and necessary to hold politicians accountable, or is it further polarizing our nation? 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us from Waukesha. Hi, Jerry. Your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are several thoughts. It was nice to hear the historical facts from your guest this morning. And quite frankly, everything that he just explained kind of mirrors what happened last year, 2020, all throughout multiple cities in this country with the Democratic Party. But we're really not talking about that. But there's enough examples right there that makes the event at the Capitol look like a July 4th picnic. So anyway, my opinions on the Trump impeachment trial, number one, there shouldn't even be a trial. Number two, I'm sure it'll reach the point of being an acquittal when it's all said and done after the actors in the political theater make their cases. It's a terrible thing for the country to even have to go through this when the former president is not even president.
All right. And I want Rick to jump in there, because that technicality issue that the Senate should not, you know, that there is no merits of a case, it's basically coming down to procedure that Trump is a private citizen and the Senate has no right to try him. Jerry saying that is how he feels. Rick, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd love to respond to Jerry's point that the Democrats supported violence last year. It's, of course, entirely false. There's not a single Democratic elected official who supported violence. What we're talking about was a broad-based movement, just of the sort, by the way, that the founders of the country, the people who created the Constitution, would have wished to see. When members of the government, i.e. police officers, acting under color of the law, basically become lawless themselves, and we're talking about, you know, cops shooting people without consequence, right? Because they're scared of black people. That sort of uprising is exactly the sort of thing that they wanted to see, right? That's exactly why we had a revolution, that we have to be a government of laws and not men. And the protests we saw in thousands of cities around America and small towns, in which basically 99.9% of the people involved were nonviolent, and then the 0.1% did things like, you know, graffiti buildings. And, you know, there were three or four buildings, you know, burned down all over the country, right? Had nothing to do with any kind of governmental actor, right? It was just people who were angry at their own community, not being able to have the laws applied to them. So the parallel is kind of absurd. The idea that a president, you know, a person who swore to uphold the Constitution would try to overturn the results of the election, would encourage violence in order to do so, is something that should make every patriotic American cry. The fact that people, you know, are willing to protest and are incredibly angry when the same government acts against people in their community is almost the opposite of what we're seeing now. And you will not find a single Democrat who did not, you know, denounce the sort of violence we saw. Whereas we have many Republican officials working under the Capitol dome who encourage violence against Democratic public officials. So I hope they take on that argument, because it really doesn't make any sense.
Author Rick Perlstein studies the evolution of the Republican Party. He's the author of a series of books on the history of conservatism. What do you think of the effect that Trump has had on the party? How do you see the GOP evolving? Should Republican lawmakers stand by the former president? Do you expect an acquittal, a conviction? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Rick Perlstein here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're looking at the identity crisis that is dividing the Republican Party through a historical lens. Republicans will have to choose sides in the Senate impeachment trial. How do you view this battle between rank and file Republicans who embrace Trump's personality, his conspiracy theories, and those trying to sever the cord on Trumpian politics? We're talking this through with historian Rick Perlstein, who's the author of a series of books tracing the rise of the modern American conservative movement. And he's with us for the hour. Let's take another call now. Matt is with us from Madison. Hi, Matt. What would you like to add?
Yes. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah. I believe the impeachment of Donald Trump is not only justified, it's necessary. Over a span of several months, Donald Trump and William Barr prepared the ground for a coup attempt to take place. In other words, it was conspired. They worked assiduously, especially when they went extrajudicial, even though that their lawsuits were had a patina of justification. When they went extrajudicial, it was clear it was a coup. Question for the guest. Some of the jurors in the Senate conspired or were at least complicit with Donald Trump. How can they function as the jurors if they conspired with the coup attempt? I'll take my answer off the air.
Matt, thank you. Rick, go ahead.
That's a fascinating question. That's something I've been thinking about in terms of the calls to, you know, sort of unite and reach across the aisle to Republicans. And one of the points I make is that, you know, we're talking about Republicans who are, in fact, collaborators, and I use that word, you know, very deliberately, the kind of collaborators with dictatorship, right? They said that if the Democrats win the election, that it will be a result of fraud, right? Judging the case in advance. And in a lot of ways, this is a trial about people who said that the election will be illegitimate if the Democrats win. And this is where you get into the history. The idea that the Democrats cannot win an election legitimately is the kind of rhetoric we've seen certainly on the right wing of the Republican Party, but also within the Republican Party since the 1960s. One of the ideas that we saw consistently in the Republican Party is that voter fraud in cities like Milwaukee and Chicago are so preponderant that we have to repress the vote of people who might commit such fraud, right? Which generally meant African-American voters. And even in the face of evidence that no such fraud existed, right? Like in the case of Chicago after the 1960 election, it was a bipartisan commission that cleaned up the elections, right? And in the case of, say, Milwaukee in 2016, where, you know, there was no evidence of fraud, that we'll call it big lie propaganda, drives an ideology that's saturated the modern Republican Party. And we're still seeing it here among senators who are, again, going to be part of the jury. They're saying, well, this violence was terrible, but I still have questions about this election that's been certified as free and fair according to the constitutional process. That basically states run their own elections, states certified the election. until, you know, this year, basically, there's been this idea that, you know, we got to keep our hands off the states when they run elections, right? Democrats propose all sorts of federal voting reforms and protections, and conservatives and Republicans consistently opposed them because they said elections were a state responsibility. Now, suddenly from the top down, including the federal judiciary, they've been trying to control the state elections. So that's part of the conspiracy, right? And that is continuous with the sort of violence we saw on the Capitol of January 6th. It's an interesting perspective I haven't heard before, and I'm going to bring that up with people. What? How can these people serve jurors when they should be, in fact, in the dock?
What does it mean for our Constitution, for our judicial system, for our election system, if someone who tried to steal the election and traffic all of these alarming conspiracy theories as truth, and they get off without any consequences?
It's very dangerous, right? So in the case of Trump, right, the president, I don't think he is, in fact, you know, getting away with no consequences. I mean, he's, you know, been impeached twice. He's going to go down in history, you know, whether he's acquitted or not. But, you know, what happens to, you know, someone like, you know, Ted Cruz, you know, who's said, oh, we need a commission to study the 2020 election, which, you know, every state attorney general certified, right? What consequences are there for that? Well, I think the only consequence is going to be a Democratic one, right? That this guy is going to face election again. And so that's why, you know, people who consider this outrageous, you know, have to keep this alive. We can't just say, oh, in the interest of, you know, unity, we have to, you know, look forward and not backward, because we're literally talking about the stuff of democracy itself. You know, whether we can continue to have free and fair elections, whether the people will be sovereign in a nation founded in 1776 on that principle. You get into very kind of very high flown civics, you know, kind of. sort of 4th of July principles very soon in this discussion. It's really remarkable how clarifying this is about what kind of country we want to have.
Well, let's reintroduce you. Rick Perlstein is a historian who has chronicled the modern Republican Party. He's written Nixon Land, Reagan Land, other books over two decades on the rise of modern conservatism in America. Taking your thoughts on this impeachment trial, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I've been listening for about 25 minutes, and this is kind of like 1984, 25 minutes of hate. So I'm hoping NPR will have a guest who will rebut some of the lies that are out there. But my specific comment is this. I find it rich that Democrats are saying we have to impeach Trump because Trump was trying to impede democracy. And the reason why is because then he can't be on a ballot again. So they're saying they want to stop democracy having Trump being elected again by stopping democracy. It's rich, it's fascinating, it's lies, and it's just Trump derangement syndrome.
Rick, do you see that as a contradiction?
Well, it's, you cannot have a society that survives if it tolerates the intolerant, right? If a democracy cannot tolerate the anti-democratic, right? So, you know, you have to have boundaries, you know, around which, you know, basically we say these are the people inside because they follow the rules, and these people are outside because they don't follow the rules. In fact, there's going to be a democratic process, right? And if you know, Trump doesn't get the votes, he's going to be able to, you know, he's going to be able to skate and run for office again. But, you know, I would like to ask the caller, you know, why wouldn't you hate someone, you know, who is so contemptuous of you as a citizen that he doesn't care how many votes he gets and thinks he should get to be president anyway? You can't have a democracy that way.
Do you sense, Rick Perlstein, that some Republican senators are open to finding the former president guilty, or has everyone already made up their minds?
No, unfortunately, our constitutional system is broken in the following way. The only way that a Republican can stay in office is if they don't lose a primary to someone to their right who accuses them of, you know, being part of this deep state conspiracy, right? The cunningness of what Donald Trump has set up here, right? I mean, he's nothing if not a cunning person, is the following. He says, if you support me and my ability to stay in power forever, no matter how many votes I get, right, then you're good, right? If you don't, then you're part of the deep state. You're part of this conspiracy, right? So once someone crosses out, crosses into that outer darkness for his, you know, cult-like supporters, then they face the risk of, now we've seen it with several members of the House of Representatives who voted to impeach, of being denounced, you know, by their local parties.
Outcast.
Right? And without
the local party. Yeah, and we're going to jump in here. Rick Perlstein, our guide to the evolution of the Republican Party and how to frame this second impeachment trial of former President Trump. We'll pick this up with the historian after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the aftershocks of former President Trump's rise to power, tracing the political chasm that led up to the violent insurrection at our nation's capital last month and the Senate impeachment trial. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One narrative, the Republican Party is at war with itself, trying to reconcile a divide between Trump loyalists and those who want Trumpism purged from the party, like the Never Trumpers who stood in open defiance of their party. So what does the future hold for the GOP? Rick Perlstein researches, thinks about this a lot. His most recent book is Reaganland, and he's with us for the hour. Rick, thousands of pages you've chronicled the modern Republican Party since the time of Barry Goldwater. What threads do you see connecting Goldwater, the late five-term senator from Arizona?
Yeah.
What threads there to President Trump's GOP?
Yeah, Barry Goldwater was a senator from Arizona whose basically his most important act that he cast as a senator was only a month before he was nominated to be the presidential candidate of the Republican Party. He voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You know, he voted for the rights of states to have laws, you know, saying you could have colored bathrooms and white bathrooms, you know, that you could keep a African-American away from a lunch counter, right? And after he was nominated, I think the most important sentence in those thousands of pages to understand what's going on now in my first book on Barry Goldwater was that one of his delegates at the convention from Texas said, we just took the Mason-Dixon line and moved it up to Canada. In other words, we made the whole country have the politics of the South. Of course, Goldwater didn't win that election, but the movement that he started in the Republican Party took it over. And of course, we had several conservative Republican presidents. And, you know, so we're talking about the politics of the South and the politics of the North. A lot of what we see in the kind of crazy conspiracy theories, the willingness to use violence when you don't get your way, was part of the normal elite politics in places like Mississippi and Alabama in the 1960s, in the 1950s, not to mention the 1850s and the 1860s, right? Like, for example, if you go on YouTube, you can hear Lyndon Johnson in a conversation with the governor of Mississippi that same summer when Goldwater was nominated. And three civil rights workers, Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner, you know, were kidnapped, murdered, and, you know, buried under a dam. And when they were still missing, the governor of Mississippi said, oh, they're not really missing. They're actually hiding. This is all a conspiracy that the civil rights workers want to embarrass Mississippi. So they created this, you know, fake news, basically. So that kind of craziness, right, that kind of willingness to go to any lengths to preserve white supremacy and reactionary minorities having power in the country, in a lot of ways, is what the Republican Party has surrendered to. There's always been other forces, right? And, you know, there's been a battle, a civil war within the Republican Party ever since that Goldwater election, even before that, when it came to McCarthy, right? And the party
look at McCarthy there for a moment. You know, the Senate voted to censure McCarthy, the Republican senator of Wisconsin. And the story goes that his colleagues recognized the threat that McCarthy posed to Democratic institutions. So they cracked down on McCarthyism. Do you see parallels or contrasts to Trumpism?
Well, the important thing is that before they censured McCarthy and the Republican Party, they welcomed McCarthy and the Republican Party, right? So there's always been this pattern of, you know, using this kind of using demagogues as a way to gain power, but also trying to kind of basically have a wall that, you know, beyond this wall of conspiracy theories, beyond this wall of attack on American institutions, we're going to push back. Right. And the Republican Party has always had that wall. Even Barry Goldwater had that wall. He said that if people started exploiting race riots in order to get him elected, he would quit the Republican. He would quit the presidential campaign. Right. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that Trump represents is he deconstructed that wall. Right. He got rid of the wall. So basically the sort of demagoguery, the willingness to kind of go say anything and do anything in order to keep power. Basically infiltrated the entire party. There's no disciplining, right? There's no grown-ups in the party saying, okay, McCarthy was fine until he attacked the army, right? Or Ronald Reagan, you know, an example I use is, you know, George W. Bush. You know, he was willing to be a demagogue to use 9/11 to start a war in Iraq that he wanted to start, right? And use the kind of general sentiment against the Muslim world. But he also said Islam is a religion of peace. Right. So there was kind of like this sort of, if we completely weaponize this sort of the animal parts of the human brain, the fear of the other, of scapegoating, racism, hatred, then we've opened a Pandora's box. Hmm. So they kind of sit on Pandora's box, right? And they let it open a little bit, right? But, you know, Trump completely, you know, opens Pandora's box. This sort of tendencies that have been building in the Republican Party, right? I mean, don't forget, you know, Donald Trump, you know, started weaponized the lie that Barack Obama might not have been born in the United States. But even George Mitt Romney, right, the birther thing, even Mitt Romney, when he was running for president, Mitt Romney is the guy who's, you know, kind of the grown up who's keeping the wall up against Trump. Mitt Romney said no one ever had to look at my birth certificate. Right. So he used it a little bit. Right. So it's a question of degree in a lot of ways.
Hmm. John is with us from Eau Claire with a perspective. John, hi, go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you. I appreciate Wisconsin Public Radio. I listen to it for a variety of opinions, and I find that your guest certainly is on an extreme end of that.
Thank you, John.
Regarding the 3/5 African-American or slave vote, it should be brought up that, yes, the South wanted slaves to count for reapportionment purposes. The North said, no, black people will only count as 3/5. That's just a historical note that I think your guest and your listeners should realize. Number two, impeachment is a political process. And I do not object to the Democrats in the House voting for impeachment. And I won't even object to those Democrats who vote to convict. But it is an illegitimate process, and that is best illustrated by the fact that our very independent and middle-of-the-road Chief Justice has refused to honor the process with his presence, even though the Constitution requires it. Number three, your guest said that no Democrats supported violence. That is very, very untrue. Kamala Harris, as a presidential candidate, numerous times defended the protesters who were burning down our cities, assaulting our police, burning cars, and killing people. She did it by raising money to get them out of jail so that they could join.
And John, I'm going to jump in here so that Rick can respond to whichever point you would like there, Rick.
Yeah, I've talked about the Southernization of politics in the United States. This gentleman, you know, uses a trope that one saw quite frequently in the 1950s and the 1960s in the South. For example, when, you know, the civil rights workers that we all lionize now as heroes were, you know, seen as part of a conspiracy with the Communist Party, right? So the idea is, you know, the 99.5% of protesters in Black Lives Matter who are, you know, basically protesting like the founding fathers did against the illegitimate use of government force, right, are equated with the 0.5% who, you know, took advantage of this to loot or were so mad that they burned down, you know, 4 or 5 buildings, not burning down cities, right, being completely contemptuous with the actual facts of what happened. And then he goes back and says, well, the Northerners acceded to the Three-Fifths Compromise. That was literally because the South said, unless you bow down before our wishes and count slaves as three-fifths of a human being, we're going to leave the country, right? So it's this kind of like, you know, gun to the head negotiating tactic, right? And, you know, you really have to ultimately, you know, and then also just to kind of like be in the broad center of opinion that basically we should have laws and the people who have the most votes in election should win, you know, is called extreme. And then the Chief Justice of the United States, who literally said, we don't need to have the Justice Department, you know, pre-clear changes in Southern voting rights laws because we don't have the kind of problems we had that the Voting Rights Act in 1965, and I'm talking about the Shelby decision that the Chief Justice wrote, we don't have the kind of problems we had in the 50s and 60s. Then immediately after he said that, the Republican state, you know, including Wisconsin, for example, you know, basically created voting restrictions of just the sort that the Voting Rights Act were designed to prevent, right? We all know that, you know, after 2010, right, when there was a reapportionment that, you know, the Red Map Project, you know, run out of Foley and Lardner so they could, you know, not have to do this publicly, but use, you know, the idea that they had attorney-client privileges, right? The thing that turned our state, Wisconsin, into a minority-run state was the Southern techniques that were used, you know, in the Jim Crow era, right? So this is why the Republican Party, this is why when George Wallace, you know, did very well in the Republican primary in Wisconsin in 1964, he said, wow, the whole country is Southern, right? So this is what we're fighting. Basically, it literally is democracy against a system of government that just basically believes that the minority has a right to rule by right, right? So I'd have to strongly disagree with the gentleman who from Eau Claire, respectfully.
Rick Perlstein, historian, has chronicled the modern Republican Party. He's with us. Rick, your thoughts on Liz Cheney, who has been called the conscience of Republicans. The Bulwark said it was Liz Cheney's finest hour, claiming that she put the country's interest over her own political ambitions by voting in favor of impeachment with Democrats. How do you view her censure against the larger backdrop of conservatism in America?
That's really fascinating. I haven't heard that she's been called the conscience of the Republican Party, or the idea that she's, you know, sacrificing her own political career. I guess I see it a little differently. I appreciate what she's done, right? But it's really, we're in a bad shape in America where to be a conscience of a party, all you have to do is follow the Constitution in the most bare basic way, right? Mm. But I don't see what she's doing as taking a risk. I see it as taking a bet, right? That basically she's leading a faction in a factional fight, right? She's, you know, the wing of the party that was dominant, you know, when her father was in the White House, you know, the wing of the party that... After all, yeah, Dick Cheney, who after all, you know, propagated a conspiracy theory that was much more dangerous than QAnon, the conspiracy theory that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and created a war, you know, that destroyed American foreign policy. The idea that suddenly she's on the left wing of the Republican Party, I see her as trying to basically make a political play for a restoration of her brand of conservatism, which after all was, you know, much more right wing when it came to starting wars of choice than Donald Trump's, right? So I see it as kind of two snakes, you know, kind of fighting each other for dominance. But, you know, if she sees it as, you know, a tactical advantage to follow the Constitution, that's great. You know, more power to her. You know, we need more people basically willing to follow the Constitution in the Republican Party.
Historian Rick Perlstein, expert on the conservative movement's rise to power and how fringe politics and conspiracy theorists take shape. Do you think we'll hear from Trump at the impeachment trial? Do you want to hear from the former president? How do you see the line between fringe elements of the party and the mainstream? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about conservatism in America. The third-ranking House Republican, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, has not backed off her criticism of former President Trump after joining Democrats and voting for impeachment. Here she is on Fox News Sunday.
We need to make sure that we as Republicans are the party of truth and that we're being honest about what really did happen in 2020. So we actually have a chance to win in 2022 and win the White House back in 2024.
We're looking at this arc of the Republican Party. Historian and journalist Rick Perlstein is our guide, and he's with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Kenneth now in Stoughton. Hi, Kenneth. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering what your guest thought of Mr. Mitch McConnell. He seems to have been in power for decades, and I don't think he really cares who the Republican president is or who the Democratic president is. So how does that affect the Republican trajectory?
Kenneth, thank you. Rick, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's kind of turned into a weather vane in this whole thing. Mitch McConnell, of course, you know, is a guy who destroyed the Senate, right? He literally said any Democrat who's president will not be able to get any legislation, and that will be our purpose as Republican senators, right? Any Democrat cannot nominate a Supreme Court member, right? That's going to be our purpose as Republicans. So, you know, he's part of this broad complex of a party that's kind of surrendered its constitutional duty, right, for power. But the question is, where does he see the power? And at first, you know, after the Capitol insurrection, perhaps, you know, because, you know, his own safety was in jeopardy, he was willing to talk about breaking with Donald Trump. And then he seems to have seen a slight shift in the wind and said, well, no, this process is illegitimate, right? Mm-hmm. And by the way, we should address this idea that the process is constitutionally illegitimate. Just this morning, the law professor who the one book length law review article examining the question of whether an officer, a constitutional officer, can be impeached after they've left office, said that the Republican brief quotes him several times, but completely distorts what he said 180 degrees apart from what he actually believed and actually argued in that piece. Right. Hmm. So McConnell is backing that distortion now. He's, you know, now betting on the idea that there's more power for him and his faction with a Trump-led Republican Party than one that rejects Trump. So it seems that that leaves us in a place where all the major power centers of the party seem to have, you know, weighed in on the side of the Republican Party being Trump. Liz Cheney doesn't seem to be succeeding in her gambit of creating an anti-Trump Republican Party. Now, the quote from Liz Cheney shouldn't be allowed to stand either. She said the Republican Party has to be the party of honesty. I don't know if she's broken with her father, right, who brought us to war in Iraq on, you know, a series of falsifications. For example, you know, the Downing Street memo said pressure from Washington was requiring, you know, England to fix intelligence around the policy. Right. Mm. So if it's, you know, honesty we want, you'd have to go much further than denouncing Donald Trump.
Lawyers for Trump this week made their case against impeachment, and they're comparing their client to former President Richard Nixon. And in their 78-page brief, they said, in the past, Congress has acknowledged and exercised its duty to not impeach when an official is no longer in office. You've looked at all of the Nixon and Trump similarities, and you have a bunch of caveats, but I'm wondering if you can help us through these comparisons.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. This is the first time I'd heard that argument, that since the Senate chose not to follow through with the trial of Richard Nixon after he resigned, that somehow sets some sort of legally binding precedent. I don't think the argument holds, right? Mm. I think the Senate didn't say that they didn't have a right to try Richard Nixon. They just chose not to try Richard Nixon. I think historians should look at how that decision came about. But ultimately, it says a lot about the Republican Party. It was inconceivable that Richard Nixon could have a political career after Watergate, right? All the people on the House Judiciary Committee who voted to acquit and not impeach Richard Nixon lost their congressional seats, right? So here we have a party that actually entertains the possibility that someone who's committed as many, you know, unconstitutional, nay, criminal acts as Donald Trump could have a political future in their party. So really what we're talking about is a shift in the Republican Party since the 1970s that's completely unwilling to reform and unwilling to kind of back away from these kind of anti-constitutional principles. The main difference between, you know, Donald Trump and Richard Nixon is, you know, Richard Nixon could sound like Donald Trump, but that was in private. You know, the kind of things we heard on the Nixon tapes. He was very disciplined about what he said in public. So it gets back to this question that basically there was always this kind of wall of respectability that Republicans tried to erect, you know, between sort of the demagogue wing of the party or the demagogue strategies and tactics of the party and the face that they presented to the public. And you saw that all the time, you know, in Richard Nixon's presidency. You know, he would say, you know, wonderful things about our ideals of civil rights, you know, when he was giving a, you know, say like a State of the Union address, or wonderful things about the ideals of, you know, ecology when he was giving an address, you know, about the Environmental Protection Agency. And then on his tapes, he would say environmentalists want us all to live in trees, or he'd say something horribly racist on the tapes. You know, for example, that, you know, abortion is acceptable if African Americans do it because it limits the black population, right? Mm-hmm. So that willingness to say things, the same thing in public and private, is the main difference between Trump and Nixon, I think.
Talking with Rick Perlstein, historian who has chronicled the modern Republican Party. Rick, how has the Christian right, the conservative Christian leaders, influenced the party? And, you know, do you see this as a fight to defend the U.S. against quote-unquote liberal secularism?
Right. Yeah, the fascinating thing about the Christian right is I think a lot of liberals kind of get this wrong. They hear the word Christian and they think peace and, you know, they think, you know, it's basically a policy of, you know, protecting the least of these. But the kind of Christianity that the Christian right has upheld, you know, since the 1970s that I write about in Reaganland is Christian nationalism. Mm. You know, the idea that America is a Christian nation, that Christians are kind of, again, rule by right. And that anyone who upholds that principle, you know, resembles, say, even if they're kind of sinners, you know, or, you know, are not the kind of person you would like to have in your church, that would be compared to, say, a biblical figure like David, right, who, you know, had an affair and, you know, sent the husband of his lover, you know, to die in war. Or the fact that in the Bible, King Cyrus, you know, a pagan, you know, was chosen by God to help defend the Jews, right? So what the Christian right is up to is, you know, this idea that their way of thinking about the world should be dominant in America. And that's been very evident in their 100% embrace, not 100%, you know, dominant embrace of Donald Trump as a hero that they lionize, not just as someone that they tolerate.
Rick, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Rick Perlstein, historian and journalist whose books explore the evolution of the Republican Party include Reaganland, his most recent one released last year. And Rick is a native of Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.